Welcome back to the Academic Agent Retrospective series. This episode is all about immigration. And over the years, I've made 5 videos specifically on the topic of immigration. You can see them here now. Some of those view counts are suppressed because some of these, like the Enoch Powell one, has been behind the paywall for a very long time. But what I really sought to do in all of these videos was to knock out a lot of the typical arguments made for immigration by the chattering classes, which is usually the economics. Usually people who are against immigration argue on the cultural side, which they say, you know, you can't measure. And I wanted to get away from that dichotomy by going hard, on the economic data, which... I think doesn't stack up. I actually think that the economic argument for immigration is extremely dishonest. And I have to credit Douglas Murray for putting me onto that, because there's a very good section of his book, The Strange Death of Europe, which dismantles the economic case. So that was kind of where I got inspired to make some of these videos. Also... I would say the Powell one is one of the spicier videos I've ever made, especially the montage section that comes after the actual, my narration, and then there's a montage, as you'll see. Does mass immigration give us cheaper food video came as the result of the debate with E.M. Penner, of course, where he was roundly humiliated on A.A. Gold. All right. Just to mention once again, there is this kind of special promotion going on with this retrospective series. If you use the code RETRO, you'll get £100 off any bundle at the Academic Agency. But with all of that said, I hope you enjoy it.
Those whom the gods wish to destroy, they first make mad. We must be mad. Literally mad. As a nation, to be permitted the annual inflow of some 50,000 dependents who are for the most part the material of the future growth of the immigrant descended population. It is like watching a nation busily engaged in heaping up its own funeral pyre.
Enoch Powell goes on to say in that speech, and I quote, "For these dangerous and divisive elements, the legislation proposed in the Race Relations Bill is the very pabulum they need to flourish. Here is the means of showing that the immigrant communities can organize to consolidate their members, to agitate and campaign against their fellow citizens, and to overawe and dominate the rest with the legal weapons which the ignorant and the ill-informed have provided. As I look ahead, I am filled with foreboding. Like the Roman, I seem to see the River Tiber foaming with much blood." From this passage, Powell's speech came to be called Rivers of Blood, as it is lived as one of the most controversial speeches ever to be given in the UK by a major politician. I've linked the full transcript in the show notes. Now, there's been a lot of fuss this week, because the BBC's Radio 4 decided to air a recording of this speech by Ian McDiarmid, and various voices from the left thought that this might cite racial violence and called for the broadcast to be pulled. Now, as someone who is the child of a first-generation immigrant and who is of mixed race myself, you might say this issue is close to my heart. Although some of the language used in Powell's speech, judged by today's standards, is racially insensitive, on this channel I have never shrunk from looking at what is, rather than what our best wishes hope for. I want to just think about what Powell predicted. This is the data on what has actually happened. Now, for those of you who do not know, Enoch Powell was a prominent conservative politician after the Second World War, and especially in the 1960s. He made the speech in 1968. Although generations since have been told that the speech caused outrage at the time, what is not typically mentioned is who this outrage was from. It was not from the people, but rather from their self-anointed keepers in the political class and the media. As Douglas Murray describes in The Strange Death of Europe, Powell was immediately relieved of his position in the shadow cabinet by his party's leader, Edward Heath, and any mainstream political support Powell might have garnered, not to mention his own political future, was over. Yet public support for his views was high, with opinion polls showing that around 3/4 of the general public agreed with his sentiments and 69% believing that Heath had been wrong to sack him. Many years later, one of Powell's conservative opponents, Michael Heseltine, said that if Powell had stood for the leadership of the Conservative Party in the aftermath of that speech, he would have won by a landslide, that if he had stood to be Prime Minister, he would have won by a national landslide. Subsequent surveys of public opinion show that the dial has not moved down on what people think about this when asked. 76% of those surveyed in 2015 said they want to reduce the level of immigration. Now, what did Powell predict? Recall he talked about the madness of 50,000 people coming to the UK. In fact, since 1999, the country has had net migration of over 150,000 every year. By my calculation, that's a bare minimum of 2.7 million immigrants over the past 19 years alone. And some years had net migration of over 300,000. So this calculation by me is drastically under what it actually was, and very much over what Powell suggested. In fact, never in Powell's wildest dreams did he think that London would be a majority non-white city by the year 2012. Now, what have been the effects of these changes? Remember, he predicted an increase in violence. Let's look at the crime data. This is the murder rate since 1900 in England and Wales. From the year Powell made the speech in 1968, the murder rates in England and Wales soared from a historic low of 0.6 per 100,000 in 1960 to 1.6 per 100,000 in 2000. So whichever way you slice it, the murder rate after his prediction is more than double that before his prediction. Of course, London itself has seen its crime rate soar, as I showed you in my video calling for Sadiq Khan to resign. Note that one part of Powell's prediction was that minorities would use racial discrimination laws, in his words, to overawe and dominate the rest with the legal weapons. What else was happening when those in the Labour Party were agitating to reduce police stop and search powers? If we break down these crime numbers by ethnicity, we can see that minority groups routinely over-index. As yet more evidence of Powell's prediction, those on the left argue that these numbers are yet further evidence of discrimination, until the end point comes in the total abjugation of the self in favour of those minorities, as signalled in this disturbing tweet in which a young woman experiences intense guilt for her own skin colour. But what about the economic benefits, academic age, and aren't immigrants good for economic growth? Well, again, let's look at the data. So between 1995 and 2014, non-European economic area immigrants are estimated to be a net cost to the UK economy of £118 billion. So there goes that idea. As I always say, focus on what is, not what you'd love to see. Today, I have been trying to get to the bottom of what the situation is really like in Sweden, especially since the mass immigration, which started in 2015. Now, this is an issue upon which people seem very divided as to what the reality is. Far-left publications such as Vice, Snopes.com, and of course the good old BBC have all run pieces denying that there is anything to worry about in Sweden. Those on that side of the argument repeat over and over again that Sweden is safe, one of the safest countries in the world. One of the safest countries in the world. One of the safest countries in the world. Those who typically oppose the left, such as Nigel Farage, and more extreme opponents, such as Paul Joseph Watson, Breitbart, and The Spectator, all maintain that Sweden is going to hell in a handbasket. These two different versions of reality seem somewhat irreconcilable. I have looked at tweets from both Peter Sweden and from Peter Factcheck, and I'm still none the wiser. There are some difficulties in gaining a real picture on this, since the issue is emotive and politically charged. On top of that, there are well-documented obfuscations in Swedish crime data which make interpreting what is happening difficult. However, in looking around, I stumbled on this post from Quora from a woman called Amelia Maria, who lived in Malmo, but then had to leave to live in the countryside, fearing for her own safety. Now, while this is anecdotal evidence and means little on its own, it did give me an idea. Amelia's answer differed from all the others I read on this Quora thread, because where the others were all explaining things and trying to demonstrate it through arguments and whatnot, Amelia showed a revealed preference. That is, she created a hard data point through her actual actions as opposed to any argument that she was trying to make. And it gave me the idea that this might be one avenue through which we might build a picture of what is really happening in Sweden. Because people vote with their feet and reveal preferences do not lie. How many other Amelia Marias are there, I wonder? Well, let's take a look. I have picked out internal migration statistics for the five areas in Sweden most impacted by mass immigration. Let's start here in 2013, before the refugee crisis of 2015. Here we can see that Stockholm was already experiencing annual net migration from overseas of almost 7,000 people per year. We can also see that around 2,800 people moved out to the suburbs, while around 4,700 moved in from elsewhere in Sweden. Since Stockholm is the capital, these are migration patterns fairly typical of Europe. London has similar inflows and outflows. And now I don't have further breakdowns of this data, but I'd be willing to bet that the majority of the Swedes coming in from elsewhere would be in their 20s, and the majority of those moving out to the suburbs would be somewhat older. What's important to keep track of is the rate of those outflows. In other regions, Malmo, you can see, has net positive migration in all three categories. And from this, we can discern that Malmo was generally seen as a place people would move to regionally, nationally, and internationally. Let's skip on to 2015 now. This is when the refugees started pouring in, of course. So immediately we can see the number of people moving from Stockholm out to the country has increased from 2,872 to 6,710. That's 141% more people in 2015 than 2013 moving out of Stockholm and into the suburbs. Meanwhile, people moving to Stockholm from the rest of the country has decreased by 15%. To me, these are signals that fewer Swedes wanted to live in Stockholm in 2015 than in 2013. What about Malmo? Well, no, 1,219 people moved out of the county, which is an incredible 491% increase from 2013. The total number of people moving in from elsewhere in Sweden did increase from 548 to 946, but overall, the city seemed less desirable for Swedes to live in 2015 than in 2013. Now let's consider Gothenburg, which seems to have experienced the highest increase in foreign immigration between 2013 and 2015. That had a 107% increase in people moving out to the suburbs. Also look at the region of Botkyrka briefly, which, as you can see, experienced similar trends. Look at that, 1,000 immigrants moved in and 1,000 people moved out. It's starting to look a little bit like white flight, isn't it? Let's keep going. This is the state of play in 2016. Now, the numbers of foreign migrants coming into Stockholm are starting to look quite big. There's a year-on-year jump from 6,980 to 8,900, about a 28% increase in Stockholm. Now let's look at the figure of people moving out to the county again. 7,989, which compared to the 2013 number is a 178% increase. Looking at Malmo and Gothenburg, the numbers in that abroad column are starting to get a lot bigger. Over 6,000 in Gothenburg now, which is a 34% increase on 2015, and 3,800 in Malmo, which is a 78% increase on the previous year. The number of people moving out to the county has stayed relatively constant, with a slight decrease in the number of people moving into Malmo from elsewhere in Sweden. But remember that moving takes time, and there could, of course, be a lag effect. You don't just get up and leave overnight. Which brings me to the 2017 numbers. What's happened here then? Stockholm's numbers from abroad are now close to breaking the 10,000 mark, and its net outflow has remained very high. But let's look at what happened in Malmo and Gothenburg. The numbers of those coming in from abroad remained constant from 2016 to 2017, but look at those net outflows. 71% more people moving out of Malmo to the county in 2017 compared with 2016, and a 41% increase moving out of Gothenburg in 2017 compared with 2016. Let's do a 2017 versus 2013 comparison, just for the three big cities. Now, I've just picked out percentage changes of people moving out of the city into the county versus numbers of people moving in from abroad. So Stockholm saw a 40% increase in foreign immigrants and a 151% increase in people relocating to outside the city. Malmo saw a 109% increase in foreign immigrants and a staggering 754% increase in people moving out. And Gothenburg saw a 74% increase in people moving in from abroad and a 245% increase in people moving out. Now, you'd have to run multivariate analysis on exactly why people are moving in each of these cases, which I don't have time to do here, but it seems to me that immigration is at least one strong causal factor in these drastic changes in internal migration rates. The fact is that fewer local people wanted to live in Stockholm, Malmo and Gothenburg in 2017 than they did in 2013. I posit that Amelia Maria's story is not just anecdotal, but representative of a wider trend that surely cannot be denied given these numbers. And I'd like to remind you, dear viewer, that these are not just statistics and numbers on spreadsheets. These are real people in the real world actively choosing where they live. If there is a 754% increase in the amount of people moving away from an area, that is a strong market signal that something in that area has changed. People who had previously chosen to buy or rent in that area now choose to pack all of their things, possibly even their whole life, and move somewhere else. It's not a small thing that can be shrugged off as a lifestyle choice. This is people's lives. This is their identities. We don't know how many of them, these people moving out, lived in these places their whole lives before. We don't know their whole stories. We don't know what they would say if we asked them why they moved. But what we can see is their revealed preferences, which do not lie. Till next time. And a very special thanks to Sir Percy Blakeney, the Crimson Satyr, Time Stealer, Nuri Nelson, Macadamia, Rosie Alpaca, Kuzga, Holy Spatula, Bruno Liette, Tragic Vision, Michael Burt, Ginger Bill, Blake Barrows, Charles Vincent, and Edward Darra. From the last census in 2011, it was revealed that around 14% of the UK population are now non-UK born residents. In 2017, the ONS revealed that 28.4% of live-born babies had mothers who were born outside the UK. So that's 138,142 babies from an immigrant background in that year alone. In 2015, it was estimated that non-European migrants have net fiscal cost to the UK of around £17 billion.
What this means is that in the year 2014-15, the gap between what immigrants paid in taxes and what they took out in government services was around £17 billion. As you can see, estimates vary, but it is in this ballpark. We can work out how many people this is roughly by dividing £17 billion by the per head tax spend in the UK, which is £9,350, which gives us around 1.81 million people. The incentives are obvious. The UK is essentially saying, come to the UK and you'll get £9,350 for free. Now, let's just take one person, an adult male. In order to be a net contributor to the economy rather than a net taker, he needs to be on at least £41,000. This means that any immigrant on less than £41,000 is a net fiscal cost to the UK. Now, naturally, this person is contributing in other ways by doing work and spending the remaining £31,418 on his living expenses and so on. But now, let's add a wife for this chap. Now, she's also a £9,350 cost. And unless she works, this family unit is now a fiscal cost of over £9,000. You see how this works. Now, let's say he brings his parents over, which very often happens, and they are retired and so don't work, and this couple have three kids. The family is now a net fiscal cost of £55,868 a year. Now, who benefits from this? Famously, there was a woman on Question Time who asked, if we stop immigration, who will make her coffee? The average salary for an assistant at Pret a Manger is £15,028 a year. That means their annual tax contributions is £1,212, making them a net fiscal cost of £8,138. What this means, realistically, is that me, you, and everyone else are subsidising the low wages for a job at Pret with taxpayer funds. The beneficiary is the purchaser of that coffee at that price point, but the low cost of labour is not being covered by the coffee sales, it's being covered by us. Of course, there are other costs too. The average waiting time at the NHS at A&E has increased by around 89% since 2007. It also puts pressure on the school system. Now think, if around one third of parents don't get their children into their first school of choice, and around 28.4% of babies being born are to immigrant mothers, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that in the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses, that will often mean that child A or child B gets the place. In central planning, which is what the school system is, categorical allocation means someone must win and someone must lose. Now, these are all broadly economic costs I've been talking about, but there are social ones too. In the past decade, we've seen whole areas completely transformed. This is not just statistics, it is people's lives, their culture, where they grew up. 37.5% of white British people from Newham left between 2001 and 2011. 30.6% in Dagenham, 30.3% in Slough, 24.4% in Luton, 12.3% in Leicester, 11.1% in Birmingham, the second city in the UK, of course. Now, it's somewhat interesting, isn't it, the sorts of stories that come from some of these towns. Newham, for example, struggles with poverty and overcrowding. Look at this story from the local Newham newspaper from just yesterday. It doesn't matter what it is, just look at those signs. Equality for all. We want justice. A look at the composition of Newham Borough Council is also quite revealing. 60 councillors, all of them Labour. All 60 councillors are Labour. This is effectively a rotten borough, a little one-party state. And who is the Lord? I mean, MP of this borough. It's this chap, Stephen Timms. Of course, a Labour man through and through. Interestingly, in the last election, he won 70% of the vote, which is roughly consistent with the demographics of this area, bearing in mind that these numbers are from 2011 and the election was in 2017. Digging even further, we can see that home ownership is very low in Newham. Less than a third own their own house, either outright or on mortgages, which is well below the rest of the UK. We can see that almost 40,000 people, just under a third, are in social housing, and the rest are in private rental accommodation. Stephen Timms won this seat in the last election with a majority of 39,883 people. The average salary in Newham is £28,780. The population of Newham is 347,996 people. The per head fiscal cost is £3,678, which means that the borough as a whole has a net fiscal cost to the UK of over £1.2 billion. We want justice, indeed. Now get out.
Seldom will one witness more statistical dishonesty than in the immigration debate in the United Kingdom. Figures from the smug and increasingly out-of-touch Hunger Games-esque ruling elites are frequently cherry-picked and designed to obscure the truth. They are constantly asking us to ignore basic economic reality by making egregious claims like, quote, immigration is not to blame for the housing crisis. Because importing 300,000 people into the country every year is not going to affect housing demand at all, is it, you totally disingenuous and sneering charlatans? For example, women such as Jill Rutter and Maria Latore have been paid by institutions such as the Equality and Human Rights Commission to push the message that immigrants do not get preferential treatment in social housing allocation. They point out that social housing stock is allocated according to a strict criteria, although, and remember this, local authorities have the discretion to add groups other than the above and will be given reasonable preference. So let's just breeze over that little detail, shall we, girls? They remind us that newly arrived immigrants from the past 5 years are not typically eligible for social housing and are overwhelmingly in the private rented sector. They make up less than 2% of the total social housing population. Hold on, I thought they weren't eligible. Anyway, if you take 300,000 as the average net migration every year over the past 5 years, that works out at 1.5 million, which is about 2% of the total population. So they're not exactly underrepresented, are they? If we zoom in a bit, we can see from their own chart that 39% of foreign-born residents in London live in social housing. So really, who cares about the ones who turned up in the past 5 years? 39% is quite a lot, isn't it? Anyone who claims this has not had an impact on the housing stock for locals is a barefaced liar, as this bar chart quite clearly shows. UK-born social residents have decreased by 22% and non-UK social residents have increased by 29%. What really irritates me is just flagrant and open dishonesty with the public over these things. If we look at the ethnic breakdown for the whole UK, we can see that black people are 203% overrepresented, while whites are 3% underrepresented. If we zoom into just London, we can find that almost 30% of social housing is taken up by black people. But this is just the data that we have. Several London local borough councils refuse to release data on this. Local councils such as Hackney, Lambeth and Newham. Who runs these places? Well, Hackney is the personal fiefdom of one Diane Abbott. Lambeth and Newham are both near total rotten boroughs. They will not release ethnicity data on their social housing list. But there's more than one way to skin a cat, if you know where to look. In an altogether different context, old Diane Mathematics Abbott, wishing to show off her diversity credentials, published a profile of Hackney, its people and place, earlier this year. This reveals a number of interesting facts, from which we can get a sense of what is going on. Only 36.2% of the Hackney population is white British. Around 23.1% is black. About 10% of the total Hackney population are on benefits, and 45% live in social housing. So, zooming in to just this one borough, we can see that this is an area with a dense ethnic minority population, and the total number of people on social housing is much higher than the national average. What is more, Hackney Council go on to practically boast that the area's population will grow by 12% in the next decade, reaching a projected 355,000 by 2050. Now, call me cynical, folks, but it's almost like it's planned, isn't it? So one can see from details like this another fact obscured by completely feckless discussions of this issue in the media. There is nothing market-driven about this process. It's a very clear case of the perverse incentives of a corrupt politician. She imports immigrants who owe her their lives because she provides them with social housing, and in exchange, they vote for the chieftain come election day. And on it goes. Hackney gets bigger and bigger as the boss woman gets fatter and fatter. Now get out.
Buy Foundations of Writing on the Academic Agency. To write clearly will help you to think clearly. The ability to communicate ideas in lucid prose is foundational to success in many areas, and it is a basic requirement in every walk of life. You will learn the parts of speech and come to understand the core functions of the English language, sentence construction and syntax, punctuation, style, and common mistakes. Once you see how mistakes are made, you will not unsee them. You will know for the rest of your life. Foundations of Writing. Buy it now.
In this video, I'm going to answer the question, does mass immigration lead to cheaper goods? In the process, I will answer two smaller questions. First, does the data bear out the claim that mass immigration has led to cheaper goods? And two, does basic economics tell us that mass immigration would lead to cheaper goods? Recently, I had a debate with a chap called E.M. Penner, who is a good representative of the sort of person who watches certain centrist channels with whom I've been engaging recently. In the debate, Penner told me repeatedly that I did not understand basic economics and that America needs mass immigration to keep the cost of consumer goods low. Just so that he cannot claim that he did not say these things or that I am taking him out of context, here is a supercut of E.M. Penner making this claim repeatedly. I've left the link to the full discussion in the show notes, should you be interested. This is just a 10-minute highlight reel. The vested interests in these companies that you're talking about, these corporations that you're talking about, are almost never in line with the masses. Let me give you an example of how corporations lobby the government to do things that are obviously not in anybody's interest but their own. Open borders. This is just one example.
No, open borders, immigration is a net positive generally. It's not that, so I understand that immigration has problems.
Immigration's a net positive generally, is it? Is it, Penner? It's a net positive.
Well, for the economy, yeah, and that's how, so the reason why we're doing a lot of immigration right now is because that's what our countries need economically in order to survive. It is. You think they would be doing it if it wasn't economically? Why do you think they're importing all these people just for shits and giggles? The reason why corporations want more immigration is because they want cheaper workers. That's a fact. I totally agree with that.
Now, is that good for you? Is that good for average Americans?
And also, a lot of time, immigrants will come in with already existing skill sets and already existing money to the country. So it's not the same, because like when someone is born as a child in the country, they have to go through the public school system. They have to do all this stuff first before they're an adult that's ready to actually start contributing to society. So there's like 18 years where they're just like a drain on society and they're a drain on the economy, as opposed to an immigrant who you can just pop over the border and he's ready to start working right away. He's ready to, you know, bring his worth into the economy, so to speak. So the idea that there's no, it's not the same thing. Immigration and birth rates, they can like be connected, but they aren't the same thing. And so obviously we need to find a balance for, so our economy can allow people to have more children, because I know a big problem right now is people can't afford them. And part of that is maybe in part because of immigration. So we can find that balance. That doesn't mean that we need to like only have immigration from white countries, or that this is like an economically viable thing. If we only had immigration from white countries, the amount of immigrants we would get would be like very, very small. It wouldn't work. This isn't how economics work. I thought you were like an economics guy. I thought you would like understand this really super basic concept.
What would you say? Well, okay, quantify it then. What's the economic boom of 12 million Mexicans joining America?
I can explain it to you super easy. It's actually kind of shocking you don't understand this. So as a society, we don't like paying a lot of stuff for certain products. We don't like paying lots of money for fruits and vegetables. We like having cheap prices. So the unfortunate thing is fruits and vegetables, a lot of this stuff, it's like really laborious manual labor to actually pick them and sort of produce these products. So naturally, most people don't want to do that. And the people who are willing to do it, they will generally want like a high pay for it because it's such a shitty job. So what happens is if people are getting paid $30 an hour to pick fucking blueberries, what's the price of blueberries going to be? It's going to be really fucking high. So in order for these products to be like economically viable, you have to get really poor people who are willing to work for like a really shitty wage to do it. So that's why do you think fucking Mexican immigrants are always working on farms and doing this shit? It's because they're doing the work that no one else wants to, so that these products that everyone wants to pay cheap money for are economically viable, because otherwise we would have to be spending like fucking $200 billion a year in government subsidies on this shit to make it affordable for the average person. Because everyone wants avocados, everyone wants blueberries, everyone wants all the luxuries of modern capitalism and the world we live in, but nobody wants to pay, fucking $5 for a banana. Like, this is basic economics. I thought you were an economics guy. Like, what? How do you not, like, understand basic supply and demand, basic, like, labor theory? Like, this is... what the fuck?
Now is that white people need to now adopt Jewish strategies to survive. Fucking sell cheap bananas. This is your argument.
No, that's not okay. So what I'm saying is the economic reality is that our economy requires cheap labor for food to be affordable.
No, it's a choice, though. It's a choice, though. It's a policy.
But people are making the choice. All people are making the choice. Everyone wants cheap bananas.
On this issue, they were never asked.
You want just like a fucking global fucking... Here's the thing. This isn't something that was done top-down. This is what happens is there are fucking individual farmers...
It wasn't a policy choice to not protect the border. It's a policy choice.
Okay,
it's a policy choice, and people were never asked by democratic vote whether they want this or not.
People also weren't asked if we wanted to bring in like Chinese immigrant labor to work on the fucking railways, because white people didn't want to do like the really shitty, dangerous jobs on the railway.
They were asked, Penner, if they wanted the Chinese Exclusion Act, and they went for it, didn't they?
Because if the people
the people don't know what they want,
People don't understand economics, Abe. You think like the majority of people understand economics? No, what they think with immigration is, oh, well, people are moving in that speak a different language and look different than me. I don't really like that a whole lot, so I don't like immigration. Most people don't understand why immigration is happening, and they don't understand how it's economically valuable, because most people aren't very enlightened on economics.
What's the economic benefit of 108,000 Somalis in London?
Fucking cheap labor. We've already been over this.
Let's just take the economic migrants from Mexico. The ones who come over.
Yes.
Are the majority of those people who are kind of people who have a, their tax footprint, are they paying more into the system than they take out of the system?
Okay, it doesn't matter because their benefits to society. Well, no, because it doesn't matter, because we're not talking about their tax benefit. The government doesn't give a fuck about how much the Mexican tax benefit is. What the government cares about is that people can buy cheap fucking blueberries and cheap fucking strawberries. They don't. We've already been over this. We've already been over the benefit.
If he's a net cost to the economy, essentially.
He's not a net cost, though. You understand how labor markets work, right? You understand cheap labor means cheap products. That's how the economy works.
You've just admitted, Penna, that it's a government subsidy in a roundabout way. Because if that Mexican is not a net contributor to the taxes,
okay. So let me conceptualize this. The government is
subsidizing that corporation to have cheaper labor.
So they would have to subsidize it anyway for more money.
There's another way you could do it. You could allow
for way more money.
All that's happening.
I agree. Here's the thing. That's still cheaper than the government actually subsidizing these companies to pay people $35 an hour to pick fucking strawberries.
The government doesn't need to subsidize them at all. Just let economics, which you're such a fan of, just let the market allow those wages to rise to their natural rate.
So that's not how the economy works, because
That's not how the economy works.
Okay, so let me explain to you what else would happen if we did that. Do you want me to explain to you what else would happen? So
another thing that would happen, if all of a sudden we were to replace like all 10 million of the illegal immigrants who are working in like the farm fields
with other laborers, we would replace like all 10 million of them with like people that we're paying for $30 an hour. So what happens then is all of a sudden that is 10 million workers that are not working at other sectors of the economy. So all of a sudden the rest of the fucking economy in these areas has a massive worker shortage. So now all of a sudden everything else is also raising prices.
Wages would rise, and so then we would need more workers. And so where do you get more workers? No, Penna, you don't need more. The average per capita income would increase, and everybody would have a better standard of living. As happened historically.
That isn't just how it works, though. So here's the thing. So when wages rise, prices also rise.
That's how it works. It only works that way because your leaders choose to have open borders. That's the only reason it works.
Why do our leaders choose to have open borders? Because our leaders have economic interests. Yes, they want the country to do well economically. People don't like paying $20 for a banana.
So let's return to those questions I posed at the start again. Does mass immigration lead to cheaper goods? Does the data bear out the claim that mass immigration has led to cheaper goods? And finally, does basic economics tell us that mass immigration would lead to cheaper goods? First, let's look at the data. California is one state that has experienced mass immigration far beyond the rest of the USA. Yet we can see from the data here that the cost of consumer goods is over 5% higher in California than in the rest of the country. I'm going to zero in on California, therefore, as our test case for the claim that mass immigration leads to lower prices. Between 1967, when Ronald Reagan was the governor of California, and 2019, which was before the pandemic, the consumer price index increased by over 751%. However, that only accounts for nominal price inflation, and since so much of that is noise from the Federal Reserve's manipulation of the money supply, we need to cut through that noise to find the real price signal. And I want to do that by adjusting for inflation and then finding the real prices of goods by studying the ratio between wages and prices. So for that, first of all, we need wage data, and then we need price data. Let's start with wages. I found that the average wages for men in the USA in 1969 were $8,455. Now, California typically has higher wages than most states, and this was certainly the case in 1969. But let's run with this number. In other words, I am lowballing the 1969 number for California. As you can see, women earn much less in 1969 than men, but that is because most women were not working, and those that were typically were in part-time work. Thus, we can more or less ignore female average wages from 1969 because most families were supported by male wages alone. If we adjust men's wages from 1969 for inflation, in today's money, it amounts to $67,200. Median per capita income in California in 2019 was just $39,393. Incidentally, I am using 2019 rather than 2021 as our benchmark here because I do not want the extra noise of the pandemic to complicate matters. We can see that median per capita income in California in 2019 for all people was even lower than the female median salary in 1969. Thus, from the data, we can see that consumer prices have increased and wages have decreased, which means in real terms, on average, most things would have been more expensive in California in 2019 than they were in 1969. So what about bananas then? I found this data from 1968, and as we can see, the average price for a pound of bananas back then was 15.8 cents. In 2019, the average cost of a banana was 57 cents. Now, before I go further, I should say that bananas are not the best example, since they are not exclusively grown in California, although some of them are grown in Southern California. But this was the example that E.M. Penner kept coming back to, so let's run with that. We need to determine the real price of these bananas by expressing them as a ratio of real wages. To do that, first, let's calculate average hourly wages by dividing the medians from 1967 and from 2019 by 2080, which is the standard working hours in a year. This gives us an hourly wage of $32.2 in 1967 and $18.9 in 2019. Now, we can express the price of a pound of bananas as a percentage of the hourly wage. And that gives us 4% of wages in 1967 and 3% of wages in 2019. In other words, the 1967 worker would have needed to work for 2 minutes and 24 seconds to earn a pound of bananas. Whereas in 2019, they would have needed to work for 1 minute and 48 seconds. This is an extremely marginal improvement, so small as to be almost negligible. The price of bananas then has scarcely changed, just a 1% decrease in real costs for the average consumer. However, costs are not absolute. They are also relative to all the other outgoings for any given person. The biggest outgoing for most people is housing, and in California, the cost of housing has increased by 30% since 1967, when we adjust for inflation. However, we need to maintain the same method as with bananas to determine the real cost of housing by expressing it as a ratio of income. We can see that in 1967, housing was 9.2 times average salary, while in 2019, it was 20.3 times average salary. Therefore, the real increase in the cost of housing was 121%. This is significant because if a greater portion of a person's income is being spent on housing, the real costs of all other goods in his consumer basket is actually higher. Now, I cannot calculate this myself exactly, it's just too complicated, but we can safely assume that a 121% increase in the cost of housing is going to wipe out any marginal benefit felt by a 1% decrease in the cost of bananas. The data tells us, therefore, that in California, between 1967 and 2019, the real cost of a banana decreased by 1%. The real cost of housing increased by 121%, while the real wages decreased by 37%. Now, okay, AA, you might say, that's all well and good, showing this empirically. But logically, why is this the case? Is E.M. Penner nonetheless right that lower costs of labour afforded by mass immigration would then lead to cheaper goods? I mean, surely that bit of logic is correct.
Well, friends, as E.M. Penner might say, it's basic economics. First, remember that prices are determined ultimately by total supply of a good and total demand for a good, not by costs. Second, the population of California has dramatically increased since 1967 due to mass immigration. Thus, any marginal gains that might have been made by the lower cost of labour, and recall we did see a 37% reduction in wages, will have been cancelled out by the higher total demand for goods. In other words, immigrants, even illegal immigrants, eat bananas too. Incidentally, I suspect the reason that a cost of a pound of bananas marginally decreased, as we saw, was nothing to do with mass immigration, but likely because the marginal productivity of each worker has increased because of automation. In other words, the greater efficiency of modern production methods afforded by more capitalistic and roundabout processes is able to output more bananas per unit of input. And this is by the by, and has nothing to do with mass immigration. And in fact, on that particular score, the actual decrease in real price of bananas is probably greater than that 1% that we saw. Really, what we're seeing is the gains in productivity pushing prices down, working against the increases in population due to immigration pushing prices up. So it's kind of ironic. Mass immigration actually wipes out the benefits that you get from capitalism, period. In conclusion, then, the data shows us conclusively that mass immigration does not lead to lower consumer prices. It also shows us that, as well as leading to lower wages, it also leads to greatly increased housing costs. Economic logic tells us that mass immigration will increase the total population, and therefore we should expect it to have an inflationary effect on prices overall. I should mention here that this is not to acknowledge the so-called non-economic costs of mass immigration, which entail the demographic and cultural replacement of the population that was there beforehand. One chap in the comments told me that his family ran a farm in California for 160 years. He personally decided not to continue running that family farm because the town in which he had grown up was now 93% Hispanic and was so utterly transformed that it felt like a foreign country to him. He did not want to stay there. And now that 160-year-old family farm is no more. The community that has sustained that farm for generations is gone, and it has been replaced entirely with a different set of people who are also, we should note, uprooted and displaced from their original homes, and in many cases made, as Penner kept on pointing out, to work for a pittance. These so-called non-economic costs we are supposed to be able to accept for the so-called economic benefits. But as I have shown in this video, there are no economic benefits to mass immigration, because it will always and inevitably lead to an increase in the demand side of the ledger. This may be good for companies who want to sell more bananas and to make more money for themselves. It is not good for consumers who want lower prices, higher wages, or affordable housing. This is the result of a political class too wedded to the notion of GDP growth, which is practically meaningless for the average person's standard of living, and far too enthralled to the demands of merchants who will never complain if the size of their total markets expand. All right, let me know what you make of this in the comments, and I'll see you next time. Oh, and I should mention very quickly, remember, there's still the autumn sale on Autumn 25. So if you are going to pick up a course at the Academic Agency, remember that and it will save yourself some money.
If you like Academic Agent's content on this channel, sign up for a course on the Academic Agency. He's now offering Foundations of Economics. Click the link in the show description and level up your econ knowledge.
Be sure to like this video and subscribe.
And if you really like my content, maybe consider joining the channel or donating or maybe even buy a mug. I am grateful for all of your support. Now get out.